Good morning and welcome to Manzanita Voices. This is Linda Field, I'm your host, and today we're going to be talking about Jane Austen with author Amy Elizabeth Smith. Amy is a professor of English literature at the University of the Pacific in Stockton, California, and she's from Pennsylvania, has been out here in California for quite a few years now teaching, and she has lots of interests. Some of them are Jane Austen, travel, and she has combined those in a way that go into the memoir that she has just published. It's called All Roads Lead to Austen. We're going to talk about all that right now. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you here. Amy, tell us a little bit about your teaching first at the University of the Pacific. I bet your students just love learning about Jane Austen.
Because there's more people who wanted to take the Austen course this semester than were able to get in. Because we like to keep the course sizes small. So I'm definitely looking forward to that. It's a fun class. And students, I give them a chance. They don't have to do a research paper in the class. They can if they want to, but I give them the option of doing a project. And so students really throw themselves into it. It's a fun way of approaching the course because Austen is about sociability, basically. That's one of the big things with her. And so I like to have students do something that gets Austen outside of the classroom so that she's not just a subject for discussion, but becomes a way of people engaging with each other.
You were telling me that you have a big, at the end of the semester, you have a way for them to all bring all of this together for the public, and it sounds like it's really a wonderful event.
It is. It's a lot of fun. So instead of just having them share the projects with me or with each other, we basically open it up to the public. So every time that I teach the course, in the beginning of December, we have a Jane Austen night. And it's a way of them getting to share the projects. If they've, for instance, I've had students who've done, a student from Calaveras County, in fact, did a fabulous little musical where she rewrote portions of Sense and Sensibility. She actually had, it was so funny, she took If You Like It, Then You Should Have Put a Ring on It, and she rewrote some of the words and had Marianne singing that to Willoughby in Sense and Sensibility.
Did she have people acting it out?
She did. She did. She actually, she got some talented friends from the area, and they helped her with it. So it was fabulous. And I've had students, we had an auction of paintings one semester. A student created some often inspired paintings. We had a student who created she was from the business school at the university, created a beautiful quilt and wrote a booklet that went with it explaining her fabric choices and the design and how it tied with Austen's work. So students, initially they hear, ooh, project rather than paper, that'll be easy. But they end up putting at least twice as much work into those projects than they would have put into writing a paper.
Yeah, just a boring old paper. Sounds like this is a really great approach for you to take. I would think that your class is very popular. It must fill up quickly every year.
Yeah, it does. No, it does, and it's fun. So, and I'm inspired by what they do. So this actually is where, along with reading the book, Azarna Fisi's book, Reading Lolita in Tehran, which sort of got me thinking about reading groups, I got my inspiration from my students to do this journey because I thought, you know what, they put so much energy into the projects that they do, getting Austen outside the classroom, I should try something like that myself.
So that's how you came to do the year of study in Central America and South America that led to your memoir, All Roads Lead to Austen. You had to learn Spanish to go and spend a year down there. Tell us about how you went about learning the language.
Well, our university, University of the Pacific, has a connection with a language school in Antigua, Guatemala. And a friend of mine had gone down there and studied and really loved it. She recommended it to me, and so that's what I did. So I took 5 weeks of immersion lessons in the break in between the fall and the spring semester. So I had those 5 weeks. I spent a lot of time learning Spanish also just listening to the radio out here in California. You know, just turn on the radio and you can find a good Spanish language station. So I, used that to get it in my ear. Then I went back for one more week to the same language school because actually, in fact, that's the place where I did my first reading group because I'd met these fabulous teachers at the school where I studied, and they were willing to they were willing to be my guinea pigs. So the first reading group that I did was there in Antigua, Guatemala with those teachers.
What book did you read with them?
We read Pride and Prejudice. I have to say it's actually not my favorite Austen novel, but it's...
What is your favorite Austen novel?
Oh, that's a long story. It's actually Northanger Abbey, and Janeites will rise up in arms over as soon as you start trying to rank the novels. But I love Gothic literature, and I love the parody. Austen's humor is really front and center in that book. I love it. But I figured that would not be as accessible as Pride and Prejudice, so that's where I started. Pride and Prejudice in Guatemala.
Just a little bit about Jane Austen herself. It's just amazing that she only had 2 years of schooling. And her brothers, of course, went all the way through college, but because she was a female, she did not go to school. But her father and her brothers were very supportive of her, helping her to write. And you made a comment the other day about, or maybe it's in your book, about how grateful you were that her father was so supportive.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It made a huge difference to have someone who, the first time, her father tried to help her publish. So Pride and Prejudice, in an earlier form, was rejected by a publisher early on, but it was her father who took the novel out and tried to shop it for her. So her family was proud of her.
Well, and I'm sure we're going to learn a lot more about Austen herself in your book. Do we do that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any one chapter that's just about Austen in the sense of background or history or biography, but, you know, in the course of questions that people asked me and events that came up, yeah, I definitely, you know, felt it was important to share specific things about Austen.
So you went to 6 countries and you read Austen with different types of groups of people in every country. Were there any people who just did they reject Austen?
Well, there was one, there was one country where we read Emma and they didn't finish the book. So Emma, when Austen was writing that work, she basically said, I am working on a novel about a heroine who people beside myself may not like very much. That's a paraphrase. And, yeah, that's Emma. So I had a group basically hit the eject button. They were like, nope, don't like Emma. They enjoyed the writing styles. Not that they didn't like Austen, but Emma just really, really irked them.
So did they read anything else with you, or did you just drop the project with them?
Yeah, there wasn't time, unfortunately, to pick something that they would have liked better. They were really interesting people, so it's not, you know, any fault of their own or anything like that. It's just that, yeah, Emma's tough.
Now, there was one country where you read with a group of people who were, basically, they were poets, they were writers themselves, and they had a different approach to the way they read and took Austen's work in and the comments that they made. It was quite different from the other people that you worked with.
Yeah, and I deliberately, instead of reading, there are 6 major Austen novels, and I was in 6 countries, but instead of reading the 6 novels, I read 3 novels 2 times each, because I thought it would be really interesting to look and see what kind of comparisons and contrasts might happen, because those 6 countries are very different from each other. There's a tendency for people in the States to assume, like, oh, they're all speaking Spanish, so they're all the same. Well, they're really, really not. As far as the poets were in Chile, and we read Sense and Sensibility, which we had also read in Mexico. And the people in Mexico were they responded on a really personal level, you know, to characters they liked, characters they didn't like. The readers in Chile were very much about, well, I'm not sure about this character's motivation, or we really don't have enough detail to understand why this happened. So they were very, you know, they were very writerly in the way they responded. So I don't know if that's so much a Mexico-Chile difference as it is a writer's-non-writer's difference. There were a lot of factors.
Was there anything in there in responses that you got any place that really surprised you?
Well, when the people hit the eject button on Emma, I guess I shouldn't have been surprised, but I kind of was. There are some other differences. To be honest, I don't want to give away too much, because there was... I found myself confronting some stereotypes I had about Mexico when it came to how people responded to Sense and Sensibility, because there were certain things I thought were going to happen that didn't. And that really made me think, like, wait a minute, why was I expecting it to go that way? Specifically when it comes to the difference between the two sisters. I kind of had my own ideas about whether people in Mexico would like Eleanor or Marianne better. They're very different from each other. That's the whole Sense and Sensibility divide. So that was one of the things that, you know, throughout the whole trip, I basically found myself having to confront some stereotypes and some pre-assumptions that I had about people. And, you know, you'd think somebody who loves Austin would know better, because that's what Austin's all about, is not prejudging people, not jumping to conclusions. Yeah, and there I was doing it anyway. So sometimes you have to kind of road test your views to really understand yourself.
We'll be back in just a few minutes with more from Amy Smith about her memoir, All Roads Lead to Austin. Welcome back to Manzanita Voices. We're talking with Amy Elizabeth Smith about her memoir, All Roads Lead to Austin. Amy and I have been doing a lot of takes and retakes on this, and I just confessed to Amy that it's because Austin and I don't click, and I'm so embarrassed about that because everybody in the world seems to love Jane Austen. And so I just told Amy that, and she really surprised me with her response.
Well, actually, what I said was that Austin's not my favorite author. That, you know, doesn't get me any hate mail or anything. I love Austin. I think Austin's is a brilliant writer. But what fascinates me as much as anything, as much as Austin herself, is the whole Austin world. And so that's one of the reasons I love teaching the class, because I love seeing, like, you know, we don't just read Austin's novels. We look at the sequels and the spin-offs and the updates and the werewolves and the vampires, all of those things. Some Austin scholars and people who are interested in Austin really hate that stuff, but I think it's fascinating. It's fan fiction. People love Austin so much that they're inspired to add werewolves to her books and rewrite them and update them. And I think that's really interesting why that happens.
And it's amazing that this woman is having so much effect on people 200 years after she lived. It's just, I think that's fabulous.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fact that it's not just scholars who are reading Austin, because there's really no other writer who has as high a critical reputation and as high a popular reputation. People talk about Shakespeare. They love Shakespeare. They go see Shakespeare's plays. But not very many people sit down and read Shakespeare. People still sit down and read Austin.
Yeah, I guess that is a major difference. Now, okay, who are some of your favorite authors then, besides Jane Austen?
Contemporary writers, I like Kathleen Norris. David Sedaris is absolutely hilarious. I love Hunter S. Thompson. I know he's not for all markets, but his books are a lot. If you just have seen a film adaptation of Fear and Loathing, you think it's all about the drugs, but it's not. I mean, he was a great prose stylist. He really was. And who else do I like? 19th century, I mean, I do like the Brontes, which some Austin fans are not wild about. Mark Twain, I think, was a fabulous writer as well. He has a reputation for having hated Austin, but Twain didn't really hate Austin. Twain had some friends who loved Austin, and he just enjoyed harassing them about it. So the nastiest things that Twain said about Jane Austen, he actually said in letters to friends.
Oh, so he was just enjoying pulling their chain.
I believe so. Mark Twain was very good at pulling people's chain.
Oh, he sure was. So then what country did you go to next?
After I went to Guatemala, I went to Mexico, to Puerto Vallarta, because I'd been there before and I had met somebody. So this is sort of a lot of this project had to do with wanting to learn about what people would think about Austin, wanting to travel, and wanting to learn Spanish. But there was a little bit of a personal element involved, because I had met somebody really fabulous when I was, I'd gone to Puerto Vallarta for a vacation. And I went back again to visit him. And then I got the idea, I wonder if he would like to read a Jane Austen novel and if he would round up some friends. So the next group that I did was in Puerto Vallarta. I lived there for 3 months. And we read Sense and Sensibility there.
Oh, okay. And did they enjoy it?
They did. Yeah, there were some people in the group who were not as wild about it as other people, but overall, people definitely liked the novel.
What about this special man? Did he like it?
He did, very much. Yeah, he got so caught up in it, he kept trying to get me to tell him about the plot as he was moving through. He got very anxious about what was going on with Marianne and Willoughby, for instance, and he really wanted to know.
So he wanted to read ahead, but he thought it'd be better to just ask you, and you wouldn't tell him.
That's right, I would not tell him.
Okay, we've been talking about Amy's book, but we haven't had her read anything yet. So this is a portion from the memoir where she's in Mexico.
My relationship with my sister Lori blossomed when she finished high school and we no longer had to share a room. But growing up, I was closest to my older brother Sean. We logged many hours together watching Star Trek episodes and Planet of the Apes films. When he was feeling ornery, he'd chase me around the house to fart on me. As Lori and our oldest brother David each hit 18, they got married, got jobs, and started families. Sean, a book nerd like myself, got a PhD, became a teacher, and stayed single. And eventually stopped farting on me, although he still enjoys farting around me and exclaiming in a pirate voice, "Arr, music to me ears!" Before time and circumstances sent the Smith kids in different directions, we four spent many happy afternoons, like millions of other youngsters raised in the 60s and 70s, playing Monopoly. At the celebration for Santa Cecilia in Mexico, Diego had shared something quintessentially Mexican with me, something meaningful from his childhood. I wanted to share something other than Austin with him, something 100% American, something from my Pennsylvania past. So I taught him how to play Monopoly. Even in the Mexican version I bought, no game says USA like Monopoly. The board center was an attractive Aztec calendar, all the properties grouped by state. The good folks from the state of Guanajuato might not be too happy to know they housed the cheapy purple properties while Mexico City landed pride of place with the costly blue ones. Boardwalk was El Palacio de Bellas Artes, and the railroads transformed into the Centro de Autobuses. I hadn't played in a good 20 years and needed to consult the rules, but it all came back pretty quickly. I explained to Diego the central challenge of the game, the need to buy property while retaining enough capital to develop it, so that you can then bleed your opponents dry. Diego's good nature did not serve him well in Monopoly. It looked promising when he bought the third yellow property after I had the first two, but that was as cutthroat as he got. Since Puerto Vallarta is in the state of Jalisco, it was only fitting that I completed this block first, those red properties that everyone lands on. Diego looked distressed when he saw my money disappearing into the bank, just like on shopping trips when he'd catch me buying yet another brightly colored blanket or irresistible owl statue. "Mi amor," he asked, "are you sure you need that many houses?" His distress changed to stunned denial the first time he landed on the Plaza de Liberación with three houses. How on earth could the rent go from $20 to $750? Now the money that had drained from my stash into the bank began flowing from Diego's stash back to mine. I had tried to explain the principle of investments and returns, but only cold, hard reality could teach that lesson. When he counted out the crushing rent a second time, I held a hand flat out, palm up, signaling, "Gimme, gimme, gimme," with my fingers, just like Big Brother Sean would always do to his beleaguered siblings so many years ago on the orange shag rug of our family den. Diego was crushed. Who was this woman, this cruel capitalist gringa, and what had she done with his bookish, impractical girlfriend? The handwriting was on the wall for his first Monopoly venture. It was getting late, and I was still more tired than usual, so he packed it up. He swore that he'd enjoyed it and would play with his family. But in the land of mi casa es tu casa, and when they say it in Mexico, they really mean it. A game where you charge your loved ones eye-popping rents until they collapse financially may not be quite the thing. For me, the game had been a wonderful trip down memory lane, bringing back rainy Pennsylvania afternoons, Velveeta sandwiches, Sean's maniacal laughter over each property acquisition, and debates over why the mice that visited the box at night only chewed the $100 bill. That's actually true. It's all true. None of these layers of memory were there for Diego, as he'd watched me fuss over the precise arrangement of the houses multiplying in my tiny empire. And anyway, he could never catch up. It was El Mariachi Loco in reverse. The second time he played Monopoly would be my 42nd. His fifth, my 45th. Stacking the bills back in the box, I smiled over at him. He sighed and smiled back.
Oh, my. Now, talk about something translating from one culture to another. Would you do that again, knowing what you know now? Would you bring out the Monopoly set again, or would you do something else?
I think I would. But I just really might try to counsel him a little more firmly about, "Look, man, you gotta be cutthroat here, or you're gonna be sorry."
Do you think he and his friends took away from that game the idea that Americans really are cutthroat and mercenary?
I think a lot of them already have that idea.
Yeah, probably they do.
But I made clear that it was all in good fun.
And this is all in good fun, too. We'll be back in just a few minutes with more from Amy Smith. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Manzanita Voices. We're talking today with Amy Smith about her memoir, All Roads Lead to Austin. Amy learned a bit of Spanish, packed her suitcase full of Jane Austen novels, and headed south to South and Central America. And she's telling us about her journey and leading workshops in various countries where she introduces a lot of Spanish-speaking people to the world of Jane Austen. And she learned a lot along the way. So where did you go next, Amy?
After Mexico, I went to Ecuador, and that was really wonderful. So that was my first venture actually into South America after leaving Central America. And I did a reading group in Guayaquil, which is a port city. I was actually, and I was intending to go to Quito, because more people, when you think about Ecuador, think about Quito, but I contracted a very strange illness in Mexico that pretty much grounded me once I got to Ecuador. It was a rough month. It was a very rough month. I have a sort of pathetic Christmas story in the chapter about Ecuador. So I didn't get to do much traveling, but it was one of the very best groups. It was a really interesting mix of people there who were in a pre-existing book group. The other two that I had done, I pulled them together with people who were interested in sharing an Austen novel and telling me about the literature they love. So that was one of the real benefits.
How did you meet all these people? How did you decide who was going to be in your group?
Well, the Guatemala group was teachers from the school, so that worked out really well. The Mexico group was Diego and some friends of his. The Ecuador group, a friend of a friend who lives in Guayaquil, found a pre-existing reading circle, and they added Pride and Prejudice to their schedule while I was there. It was very generous of them. And so that, I think, was one of the things that made it such a lively group, is because these are people who've been reading books together, some of them for more than 5 years. So adding Jane Austen in there was interesting because I got to see how they compared her to other works that they were reading. And they were really, you know, kind of arguing with each other a lot. It was a lot of fun.
Now, is your book printed in Spanish as well?
That's actually an issue. I have spoken to my publisher about this because my husband, who I met on the trip, I don't want to say what country he was in, which of the reading groups, but he would very much like to translate it. And so I'm talking with the publisher about that now. I would like to see it translated into Spanish, and I would like my husband to do it.
Oh, that's wonderful. And, yeah, then you can make sure that everyone that you were in these groups with in all these countries gets to read your book and read about themselves and how they fit into your journey.
Absolutely, yeah, because some of the people who I worked with do speak English, but some of them don't. And I was all on my travels the whole time, except for a little bit in Paraguay and a little bit in Ecuador. I pretty much stuck with Spanish as I was traveling.
So what other country? You went to a total of 6 countries, right? And you've told us about 3. So what were the other 3 countries?
Well, the country where I actually spent the most time was Chile, because I was teaching there for a semester. So I was on sabbatical for a whole year, but part of that year was spent teaching for a semester in Chile. And I was teaching exchange students, so they were actually Canadians and people from the United States. So I was doing that in English. But everything else, so I was there for 5 months. It was really, I loved Santiago. I had a really wonderful time there. And all of the people, sort of in honor of Pablo Neruda, who's the most famous Chilean poet, along with Gabriela Mistral, I did a group with poets. So all of the people except one in the reading group in Chile were all poets. So that was very interesting to see some of the differences between how they read Sense and Sensibility compared to the people in Mexico.
And what were some of the differences?
Well, one of the big things was that since they were all writers in Chile, they tended to they talked about Austen's, her strategies, the way she used irony in the book. So they were very sort of writerly comments. They were interested in how she was doing what she was doing, whereas the people in Mexico tended to be much more engaged by some of the moral questions and how they responded to the characters.
interesting, the different approaches that people took to reading the books. So after Chile, where next?
From Chile, I went to Paraguay, which is a country that most people don't even know exists. I hate to say that. Pardon me, all my friends in Paraguay. But, yeah, it's a little landlocked country that almost didn't exist because it was one of the bloodiest wars that's ever happened. Happened in right after our U.S. Civil War in Paraguay, the War of the Triple Alliance, and it was nearly, literally wiped off the map. Something like 90% of the male, more than 90% of the male population was killed. So it's really, it was a fascinating country, but it's very, you know, it's very economically challenged. It's it was, you know, a little dicey, and the capital city of Asunción, I was very happy to stay there, but you know, it's they've got a lot of problems. But I worked with some really interesting readers there. Actually did two separate groups, which wasn't plan A, but that's, you have to be ready when you're traveling for things to need to be reconfigured.
Now, how did you decide to go to Paraguay?
There's a wonderful alum from our university who lives down there with his wife, who's actually, she's originally from Turlock. And I stayed with them and visited with them, and they're the ones who helped me arrange the groups. Yeah, and the next country, the last country, was Argentina. And I had had a lot of people, when I was doing some reading and about thinking about Latin America and where I would go, it kept coming up over and over that Argentina, and particularly Buenos Aires, is the literary capital of South America. I kept hearing that phrase. So I thought, okay, I'm taking Austin for a little tour. I certainly should take her to the literary capital of South America. Chileans would dispute that in Santiago. But it was wonderful. And I didn't know anybody there. So that group, I actually basically just started wandering around. I went into bookstores. I went to the National Library and was like, hey, I'm here, and I'm an American, and I want to do a reading group on Jane Austen. So my Spanish was good enough at this point that I was able to manage, and I rounded people up.
Wow. And your Spanish does sound wonderful. I mean, your accent, I don't know Spanish that well, but it sounds to me as if you have a really good accent. And I suppose studying, immersing yourself the way you did is what helped with that.
Well, yeah, I found Spanish speakers really patient. So I found it very easy to work with them, and people didn't, you know, make fun of me or give me a hassle if I couldn't say things quite right. I found them very patient, good listeners, very helpful. So that was, yeah. And I actually, my original field is music, so my grammar is not so great, I have to say, with Spanish, but my ear is decent, so that helps.
Do you sing?
Yes.
Yes. Oh, I didn't know that. Well, how wonderful. You met all these people, and are you still in touch with most of them?
With most of them, I am. So I'm Facebook friends now with some folks down there, and yeah, for the most part, I am. It was a little. There were so many people involved that I'm afraid over time I have lost touch with a few people.
Uh-huh. Well, I guess that happens. But I think you're just so gutsy to pick up and go the way you did, and go to all these different places. And it is wonderful how one thing seems to lead to another, and you meet people in one country who know someone somewhere else, and they send you along. And it seems like you had a lot of good connections that you built along the way. Now, all of these people and all of these events show up in your memoir, All Roads Lead to Austen. How long did it take you to write the book, actually?
I started writing it when I was still traveling. So when I was in Mexico, I began the first section, and so that was the fall of 2006. So I actually finished it 2011, so what is that, 5 years? With some, you know, some complications in between, with trying to get my fiancé and now husband into the country. That was really a tangle. And just needing some time to develop the idea, because I've never written a book like this before. I've published scholarship for years. I have a PhD in British literature. I wrote articles on 18th century travel literature. So this was really new to write something like this, and to write a memoir too. So it was a bit of a challenge to figure out how I wanted to organize it.
Oh, I can see the organization, but actually the writing of all the experiences, I would think that would have been kind of like a revisiting of the journeys that you took, and it must have been a lot of fun, too.
It was, yeah, definitely was. And, no, I enjoyed writing it, but it was, you know, and there's so much more that I could, this book could have been three times as long. I met so many fabulous people and had so many great experiences, and a few not so great experiences. Some of them made it into the book. But picking and choosing was a challenge.
Yes, the editing and the leaving in and the taking out, all those decisions, that's one of the hardest parts of writing a book. We'll be right back with more from Amy Smith. Stay tuned. Welcome back. We're talking with Amy Smith about her memoir, All Roads Lead to Austin. And Amy, before we go any further, your book is—it's going to be officially out on Friday, right? And
yeah, I believe it's May 25th. So the book is on Nook already. It was released on Nook on April 30th, and it will be in bookstores, in Barnes & Noble and independent bookstores and other places, I believe, as of the 25th. Amazon is listing June 1st as the release date.
Okay, and you have a website.
I do have a website. It is the same title as the book, allroadsleadtoaustin.com. So I've got a little more background information. I've got some nice guest posts on there from other people who've... Because for me, the website is not just about my book. It's about all... It's literary inspiration in general, Jane Austen in particular. That's my theme. So I've got things up there about people who are inspired by different writers and things about Austen as well. allroadsleadtoaustin.com.
We're finishing the writing of the novel, and did you have other people edit it for you?
I did. I had some close friends who read it, some good friends from my undergrad degree, people I've stayed in touch with, people who I trust to be able to give me honest feedback, because that's so hugely important that you can hand something to a person and they'll really be able to tell you, yeah, this isn't working. I think you should consider doing this a little differently. And so, friends who were supportive, but honest. Mm-hmm. And so at the early stages, I started circulating chapters as soon as I had a few chapters. With nonfiction work, you can actually get an agent and begin to try to sell your work before it's finished. If you're writing a novel, it needs to be done. An agent is not going to look at your work until it's all the way finished, because it's such a competitive market with fiction. It's a competitive market with nonfiction, too, but it's a different sort of market. So before the work was finished, I think at that point I probably maybe had two sections on the first two countries finished. And then I wrote a proposal and began planning to approach an agent. And what ended up happening in my case, here's the lucky break part of the story. I had been exchanging work with a friend who was working on a book on one of the first people to receive insulin, Elizabeth Evans Hughes. And when she began shopping and was looking for an agent, she got an agent, and that agent said, your manuscript is in really good shape when you brought it to me. And my friend said, oh, yeah, I have a friend who's been helping me edit and who's working on a book herself. And the agent said, really, what kind of book? And my friend said, a book about Jane Austen in Latin America. And the agent says, that sounds very interesting. Would you have her send it to me?
Oh, my goodness, what luck.
Yes, and so it's definitely luck, but it's also the fact that I made the effort to be out there reading somebody else's work and getting somebody to read my work. So I think it's very important for people to not just to be sitting home writing in their den, to make connections with other writers.
That's right. Yeah, it's so easy to go into a cave when you're writing a book. It is a very lonely process. And you can really cut yourself off from a lot of people. And what you need to do is be out and do a lot of networking, attending workshops and conferences and things. And so, sounds like it really worked for you in a great way.
It did. And so when I showed Lisa, I wrote up a really short one-page proposal, and she said, this is great. Now we need to expand this into the kind of proposal that publishers are going to want to see. And we worked with it. I feel like I spent more time on that proposal than I did on the book. It was really grueling. So this is where, sometimes people, I think there are definite virtues to going with the route of self-publication, but I think sometimes people go that route because they get too bogged down in the proposal stage of trying to get a publisher, because it was really, we went through three rounds. It got rejected, she'd send it back and asked me for more, some changes and so forth. It was really, I was close to giving up, I have to say, when we were going through the third round. But I just thought, I'm committed to this project, I think that people will want to read it, and I stuck with it. And my agent, fortunately, stuck with me too. It was in the third round that we sold the book.
That's great. You must have been thrilled. Did you celebrate?
Absolutely. I was so happy that I would not have to write the proposal ever again.
How did you find out that it was accepted?
Email. I got email from my agent saying, okay, we have a taker. And, you know, she, you know, when she wrote to me that it was Source Books outside of Chicago, I already owned books by this publisher. I don't know why we didn't think about this publisher in the first round, because they published so many Jane Austen titles. And they've been absolutely fabulous to work with. The publicist who's been working with me has been really smart, very attentive. You know, the whole experience, I feel like my book is, and again, you know, sort of for people who think about self-publication or trying to make that decision, it was, my book is much better because I had an editor who had a financial stake in helping me write a better book. And she gave me really good suggestions. She was honest with me. And she said, look, no, this should be changed. And I'm not saying that she made me rewrite the book, because there were certain things she wanted that weren't the direction I wanted. And we, you know, she was flexible. But overall, it was a very good experience.
I know some writers who are working on books who say that they are very happy with writing the work themselves and then going over it themselves and being their own editor. But the more I learn about this process, the more I think that that is not a very profitable way to go. If you want to write a book just for yourself and your family, it works okay, but really it is very valuable to have someone else, a professional, take a look at your work, right?
Yes. Yeah. And even with self-publication, you can certainly hire an editor, but I think it's a sort of different relationship when you're working with an editor within the publishing house that's actually publishing your work. So, other people will see things that you cannot see. Mm-hmm. So I am so thankful to friends who gave me help with the work. The Writers Unlimited group here, I didn't become part of that group until pretty late in the game, but when I shopped, you know, when I brought the introduction to one of the workshops, I got some very helpful feedback. And I think working with other people is, for me, it's indispensable. I mean, maybe somebody out there is brilliant enough that they can pull it off without any help, but I needed help, and I was very glad to get it.
Yeah, it makes me wonder about the writers that we read who are historically so great. For instance, Mark Twain. I wonder how many people he had look at his work before he published it.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea.
Good point. Yeah, with Austen, we don't know. We know that she read things out loud to her family. She certainly did that when she was a young girl, some of the crazy stuff she wrote when she was a teenager, which survives as juvenilia, if you ever want to hunt that up. Very funny. But it's a good question. I mean, I think, and I'm not just being facetious about the brilliant. I think there are some people who really, you know, have enough faith in their own voice, and they just, it just comes out the way they want it to. But even a great writer like Flannery O'Connor, I know, for instance, that she was very careful about getting feedback and rewriting things.
Yeah, it just seems that it's necessary for 99.9% of the people who are writing. And it's sad that some of them don't know it, because they're writing really good things, and yet they may never see publication or a great readership, because they just haven't given it a chance to be seen by other eyes. We're almost out of time. I want to be sure that we get a chance to tell the audience one more time where they can find your books and also your website, which is very easy to remember. Even I remember it, allroadsleadtoaustin.com. And your books are out at Nook right now, Barnes & Noble?
Yes, and whatever independence. So IndieBound, I'm sure you could order it if you're an IndieBound fan, to get it from them, or whatever local independent bookstores are in your area.
Okay. Can they buy it directly from you, from your website?
No. This website will direct you if you want to go to Amazon. And I need to get my website set up for IndieBound, because independent bookstores is very important to me to support them, but I need to get the person who's helping me with the website help me get that set back up, so that I can also have IndieBound on there.
Oh, yeah, that would be great. Well, you've been a wonderful guest. I've really enjoyed talking with you today.
Well, thanks so much. Thanks so much for having me. I this was such a great project that I love sharing it with people. I love talking about it.
Oh, I can tell that you do. And I invite you back again sometime soon. I understand that you're leaving on a trip. You're going back to Pennsylvania. You and your new husband are going back to visit your family in Pennsylvania. Hope you have a wonderful, wonderful trip.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, we'll be a road trip, his introduction to North America, so it'll be fun.
Okay, and everybody, you should read the book, read Amy's memoir, and see if you can guess which person it is that she met, which one that she met on her journey is the one who is her husband. He's a lovely man, wonderful man. Have a great trip.
You've been listening to Manzanita Voices, a production of the Manzanita Writers Press, an affiliate of the Calaveras County Arts Council.